gets. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Given the rash of mass shootings at schools and shopping centers in recent years perpetrated by those with mental issues, it is clear that mental health care or access to it needs to be ramped up in the United States. In this region, Carolina's healthcare system is about to take a unique approach to increasing access. Already an innovator in the care of stroke patients and with their children's hospital, they've now turned their attention to making behavioral and mental health far more accessible across their system by launching a pilot program that takes advantage of a rising new type of medicine called telemedicine. In this case, telepsychiatry. We're going to find out more about that this hour. Dr. John Santopietro is Chief Clinical Officer of Behavioral Health at Carolina's Healthcare System. Nice to have you with us. Martha Whitecotton is Senior Vice President of Behavioral Health there. Dr. Wayne Sparks is Director of the Emergency Department and Telepsychiatry at CMC Randolph. And Julie Roddy Paul is a member of the Patient Advisory Council of the Behavioral Health Center in Davidson. Welcome to you all. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
We're excited to be here.
I mentioned the rash of shootings around the country in the last year or so, or 3 or 4 years, I suppose, all of which involved people with mental health issues. Dr. Santopietro, you were involved in the psychiatric response to the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Is it fair to say that the rash of these incidents has finally raised awareness of the need for greater access and perhaps more mental health care, better than almost anything else in the country?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mike. First of all, I really want to thank you for having us here, the behavioral health team at Carolina's healthcare system, and also specifically for having shows on mental illness and mental health care. I heard, for instance, a show that you did with folks from Alexander Youth Network on childhood trauma, which I thought was phenomenal. And I think getting the word out about behavioral health actually saves lives, so I want to thank you for that. It's a good question. There are two reasons that we're having a dialogue about mental health like we have not had in 50 years. One of them happens, unfortunately, to be those incidents you're talking about. The second, though, which I think is more important, is that healthcare reform is happening. And healthcare reform, just to kind of boil it down, is about changing from a system based on volume. So we do more MRIs today because that's what we do, to a system that's based on value, which is about cost, what drives cost in the system, and how do we provide the right care at the right time. And when the system changes to that kind of an outlook, all of a sudden behavioral health rises to the top because untreated behavioral health issues drive humongous cost in the system. So that, I think, is actually a more powerful driver of attention at a deeper level, which will affect change.
Let me clarify something you just said, because you used the term healthcare reform, and that may be confused with the Health Care Reform Act or Obamacare, and maybe it should be. Is that part and parcel of that act, or is this something separate from Obamacare?
Yeah, they're related. You know, the Affordable Care Act is one sign of healthcare reform. I think it's a pretty important one. I think it signaled that something will be happening, whether it is that, you know, that piece of legislation or something else, or the system as a whole needs to change, or else basically we're going bankrupt as a country. We spend almost $3 trillion on healthcare. Interestingly, we only spend $100 to $150 billion on mental health care, which is one of the reasons we have a broken system. If you look at healthcare spending as it relates to GDP, that of course has increased over the years, year by year. If you look at mental health care spending over the years, it has remained constant and flat.
So why?
There's a variety of reasons for that that boil down to state by state kind of politics, the stigma that goes into things nationally, not investing because of stigma in research and.
Will the healthcare reform that we have enacted, if it stays in its present form, will that give more people the ability to get mental health care treatment because they are now insured where perhaps previously they were not?
Yep, that's a great question. Especially with Medicaid expansion, the number of people with behavioral health issues that will be covered would be increased and will be increased significantly. So Medicaid is the largest payer for mental health services in the country. But in general, I think the point, the subtler and I think more kind of mutative process is that as we move to a different healthcare system, which is driven by value, which is driven by we have to look at this population of people and provide the healthcare that keeps them healthy, all of a sudden what we have known for years, really decades, about untreated, undertreated mental health care driving cost in the system, so people ending up in emergency rooms because there are no other places for them to go, all of a sudden that has the attention, you know, while the news stories about the tragedies has the attention of the general population, the healthcare reform issues have really remarkably gotten the attention of healthcare executives, of policymakers, of really of Wall Street, because they notice that people getting readmitted to medical hospitals, which is a big driver of cost, often have untreated mental health issues, things like that. So all of a sudden, we become relevant in a very different way. And I think it harkens back to the 1960s, where there was a wave of reform at that point. At that point, it was about getting people out of state hospitals. We're at a different moment now where the energy is just as intense, but it's about we have this community of people and a number of them, one out of four, one out of five of them that have a mental health issue walking around today are suffering. In fact, we only treat effectively 5 to 10% of people that have a mental health issue, which is remarkable. It's even more heartbreaking when you think about we have treatment where 60 to 80% of people could recover if they got the right treatment at the right time, but we only actually begin by treating 40% of people to start with.
Is that why the hospital system says that we are facing a behavioral health crisis today? Is that why?
Because absolutely. Absolutely. And the people, when people go without treatment or access to treatment, then they show up in emergency rooms or show up in their physician practices time and time again with physical complaints, often masking the untreated mental illness. And then that escalates healthcare costs as they seek treatment for physical complaints because they have untreated mental illness that's going unaddressed.
And Dr. Sparks, you are the director of the emergency department at CMC Randolph. How many of the people who present at the emergency room do you find have mental health issues?
Well, in our emergency room, it's totally dedicated to psychiatric or behavioral health emergencies. It's part of the CMC main hospital, but we also see a lot of patients at other hospitals that there's typically several a day or many a week that will need some sort of evaluation in medical ED.
When we talk about people who are walking around with behavioral health issues, what are we talking about? I mean, I know obviously there's schizophrenia and there are other issues like that that everybody knows something about. But what are we talking about? Because the average person, is the average person walking around with some form of a mental health or behavioral health issue?
Well, so it's a great question. It's a great way to begin looking at the problem in a very kind of basic way. And studies are pretty clear. Any given moment, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 adult Americans is managing some behavioral health issue. Most of that is
That's
mild.
That's enormous.
Exactly. Yeah. Most of it's mild, moderate to mild. Then 5 to 7% of folks are dealing with a very significant mental health issue. So that would be something like severe bipolar, severe depression with suicidal thoughts, or schizophrenia. But it's a remarkable number of people.
Well, if 20 to 25% of the population at one time or another is dealing with mental health issues, what kind of issues are they dealing with? What would cause me to go see you, for instance?
Yeah, the most common diagnoses in the country are depression and anxiety, you know, and then right after that would be substance use issues, and then it's the smaller percentage where you're talking about bipolar, major significant depression with suicidal thoughts and schizophrenia.
So if I'm walking around with anxiety, at what level of anxiety should I seek somebody like you out? I mean, everybody has moments of anxiety. Everybody has moments of depression.
I think when it starts to impact your ability to work, your ability to carry on your activities of daily life, interacting with your family, carrying on your work responsibilities, your family responsibilities, when it starts to impact your ability to live your life to the fullest, then it's impairing your ability to do the things that you would do.
And do most people who are in that situation that you're talking about, do they seek out help or do they not seek out help, either because of the stigma attached or because of lack of medical coverage, insurance, et cetera?
Well, I think Julie's a great example. Yeah.
All right, Julie, you were actually a patient before you were on the patient advisory council.
I was, and I had depression and anxiety and panic attacks. I absolutely let it get to crisis level before I could go to Carolina's Healthcare Behavioral Health on Randolph to get treatment. Stigma was absolutely what kept me from going. It was a family code of you only want to be perfect, you want to just show a certain perfectness to the world, and it was frowned upon that you would want to seek out any kind of treatment. That started at my family level.
And this was this is only mental issues.
This was my depression, any mental issues.
If you'd had eczema, you would
Absolutely.
Have seen a doctor.
Absolutely. My parents would have seen a heart attack different from mental illness.
Okay. All right.
Easily. So I lived through those very things Martha was speaking to, that kind of frozenness of needing help but not knowing what to do, or feeling helpless and hopeless and not wanting to go forward.
What pushed you over the edge to actually seek out
treatment? Absolutely. I had gone through some life crises, breast cancer, a husband leaving me, having to sell my house, move, and get a job all within about 5 months.
Those are all major life stressors.
They are. Yeah. And I was responsible for raising my two children at the same time. And so I was in a survival mode to kind of get to a certain place, but at one point the triggers came and I had to go seek help because I knew if I didn't, I wouldn't be a good mother to my children.
And here you are, mm-hmm. going from that point where the family pressures
Absolutely.
Would have prevented you from getting help
right.
to sitting here on the radio talking about having gotten that help.
It's come full circle for me.
Yeah. Talk to me about that, sure. because that strikes me as being very brave.
Well, it does take some bravery. It also courage. Courage is the word, and it's very difficult to muster that up, but for me personally, I knew that I didn't want that legacy for my children, and I knew that I needed a honest conversation with them about mental illness, since I knew it also could be carried in our family.
Mm-hmm.
We had a history of depression, anxiety, and obsession-compulsion disorder. And if you don't talk about it, you can't get the resources and you can't feel comfortable. So I wanted to start being the change agent in my particular new family, my two children and myself.
We've done so many programs on mm-hmm. heart disease and cancer and mm-hmm. things like that, and CHS says that mental health disorders are more disabling to the community than cancer or heart disease in terms of disability and lost productivity. Is that why you are allegedly investing in behavioral health care system like no other hospital system in the country?
Yes, absolutely. And I just wanted to reference one of the things that Julie said when you said bravery and she said courage, and they sounded like the same thing. That the root word of courage is your heart,
uh-huh.
and I think that's really important in her response. You know, clearly it's about telling your story from the heart. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do at Carolina's healthcare system, when you say why are these people walking around, it's because they need treatment and they need it.
We have to take a break. I want to get an answer to the previous question, which you didn't have a chance to answer in a second. That's Dr. John Santopietro, who's the Chief Clinical Officer of Behavioral Health at Carolina's Healthcare System. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bilo Supermarkets, serving the Southeast for over 50 years. Bilo offers bonus fuel perks items with the Bilo Bonus Card. Store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks program details at buy-low.com. www.thewarsofmass.com. During the Cold War, U.S. foreign policy was pretty simple, pretty cut and dry. In the age of terrorism, our foreign policy has been less clear, more difficult, and getting it right seems even more important. David Rothkopf is CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine and the author of a forthcoming book on national security in the age of terrorism, and he talks about foreign policy decisions in both the Bush and Obama years tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Supreme Court largely upholds the EPA's right to limit greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. What the ruling means for utilities and the Obama administration's efforts to combat climate change.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about behavioral health and the fact that Carolina's healthcare system is making a major investment in improving access to that form of treatment. Dr. John Santopietro is with us, the Chief Clinical Officer of Behavioral Health there. Dr. Wayne Sparks is Director of the Emergency Department and of Telepsychiatry, which we'll be talking about in particular in a moment or two at CMC Randolph. Martha Whitecotton is the Senior Vice President of Behavioral Health for the hospital system, and Julie Paul is a member of the Patient Advisory Council of the Behavioral Health Center in Davidson, which is operated by Carolina's healthcare system. During the break, Martha, you were saying that for every Julie Paul, there are one or two others who get turned away because either they can't afford to pay or something happens on their road to getting help. Well, right. Give me some examples.
So for every Julie, there are patients who seek services and either get an appointment, but that appointment is 3 to 6 months out. So they may get a referral to a psychiatrist or to counseling, but that appointment is 3 to 6 months out from the time that referral is made because the backlog to services is so long. And there's so much demand for services and so few services available, or they cannot get an appointment because they have no funding. So they're completely uninsured, and many of these people have jobs, but they have no insurance, or their insurance doesn't cover mental health services. And so they can't find a provider that will take them because they have no insurance. So
how are you helping?
So what we are proposing to do is use the technology that Wayne has and his team have perfected by using telepsychiatry in emergency rooms and take that same technology and work in our primary care practices across the system.
Because there are 28 counties in North Carolina, I'm told, in which there is not a single psychiatrist.
Correct.
28 out of the 100 counties.
And I'd like to add that once I was discharged from Carolinas, they had said I need to get in contact with a psychiatrist. They'd given me a 30-day supply of antidepressants, and it was running out. Psychiatrists were booking 2-3 months out. I was desperate because I needed to continue my medication. So I went to my frontline OBGYN thinking, hey, he's probably dealt with postpartum depression. Maybe he can help me. And that's what Carolina's is. New direction is helping educate the frontline physicians.
If you have some mild form of behavioral health disorder, is it likely to get worse in the absence of treatment? And if you get treatment earlier, are you more likely to get a cure or reach a positive outcome?
Yeah, absolutely, Mike, and that's well proven. And it gets to your earlier question about disability. The reason that there's a much larger burden of disability with mental health disorders is because they strike early. So the average age of onset is late teens, early 20s, whereas cancer and heart disease and even diabetes generally is later. So in the workforce, it pulls people out of the workforce early.
If you get a physical illness, it's easy for people to understand what's going on. Even non-scientific, no one with a doctor's degree can say, oh, well, you've got this or that condition. You have a virus or you have a bacterial infection. We understand that. What is going on in someone's head that we cannot see, that they didn't catch because somebody sneezed in their direction? What's happening?
Yeah, that gets to another great point. So imagine when you, many years ago, walked in with a broken leg before there was an x-ray, mm-hmm. and a doctor had to explain that to you without an x-ray. Well, that's where we are in psychiatry. I mean, we can show MRIs and functional scans, and but we really haven't got a technology yet. I think we will in 10 or 20 years be able to show you a scan. This is your 12-year-old kid's, you know, brain, and we're worried about it for this reason. But we're still not there yet. And that's one of the reasons that there is more stigma in mental health, because it's harder to talk with patients about it. We still have to describe mostly symptoms and diagnose based on symptoms. It's very one of the contributors to stigma. Another contributor to stigma is that people don't see other people in their community getting better. Again, this only 5 to 10% of people are getting appreciably better.
So if you suddenly at the age of 15 or 16 or 17 come down with something non-schizophrenic, but just something, some behavioral health disorder, what has happened in your brain? Is there something going on in the brain? Is there misfiring of synapses, improper development of certain areas? What's happening?
Well, it's always important to refer back to the fact that it is your brain. I think that's one of the things that we tend to forget about. We're very quick in this day and age in this culture to be thinking about this as a moral issue, this is a character issue. But whatever it is, your behavior originates in your brain. And so primarily we think about mental illness as a brain disorder. There's lots of different kinds of mental illness, and there's different things going on in the brain. But again, I think because of stigma, because we're not investing as much as we need to in mental health research, we're not, for instance, where people are in cancer looking at, well, this, you know, this cancer has a certain genetic mapping that we can do. I think we'll get to that point in mental health, but not for a while. But the point is that even today, even with the treatments we have today, without inventing a new medication, 60 to 80% of people will recover with the treatment that we have today, but 5 to 10% do. So that difference is, in my view, a pretty good measurement of just how broken our system is and what drives us.
And the 5 to 10% who do get help and get and have their problem solved, is that because they sought treatment or is it because of some other factors?
That's it. When they've navigated this obstacle course that you and Julie and Martha are talking about, so they have insurance that pays, they had a good enough experience of care where they didn't feel stigmatized and they didn't get bounced around and they didn't have an appointment in 6 months when there happened not to be a bus to take them to that treatment, whatever. They've navigated that.
Now, you were involved in the Sandy Hook shooting and the aftermath of that, with helping people get through that. And when you look at what's going on with the VA hospitals and the outlandish amounts of time it takes to get care in some of these hospitals, do you worry that we're going to see an increase of these incidences because of the returning numbers of veterans who are facing behavioral issues as a result of their experience in Iraq and Afghanistan who have not been able to get access to help?
Well, you touch on several issues. One is we're very concerned about our vets coming back and the increased rate of suicide in that population. A couple years ago was the first time there were more deaths by suicide than combat deaths in this country, so we're very concerned about that. With respect to the VA issue, and I don't know it in great detail, what I would say about it is that it opened a window onto a healthcare issue that we in behavioral health see all the time. So we see that kind of lack of access all the time, day after day. Again, what brings us to the microphone, I think, is that we're relevant now to the larger discussion in a different way, partly because of those tragedies, which is, again, not a good reason to be at the microphone. And that overemphasizes the linkage or a linkage between violence and mental illness, which is really not true. But the other more important reason is that healthcare is changing and we are very relevant in that discussion.
So to increase access, Carolina's healthcare system is embracing what has been described as a rising form of patient care, and that would be telemedicine and, in this case, telepsychiatry. What exactly are we talking about here in
okay.
these modalities?
Okay. Telepsychiatry is video conferencing with a patient. It's we have equipment set up in 12 of CHS emergency departments now, and we have the same equipment at Randolph for the psychiatrist. It's high-definition video and audio, and it's as if you're doing a face-to-face interview with a patient. So we've been slowly building this. We've been doing it for years.
So if a patient presents this only takes place in emergency rooms around the city?
That's the main part that we're doing, emergency rooms. We're also starting to do some inpatient consults for one hospital we're doing. And the other project of this is a integration into primary care offices as well.
So if somebody shows up at CMC Maine in the emergency room and a physician determines that this person, although they may have some physical problems, also has some mental issues, what happens? They sit them in front of this camera and they talk back and forth with a psychiatrist someplace within the system?
Correct. This is they're seen by the emergency physician and determine that they need to see a psychiatrist. We usually have a behavioral health clinician, which will see a patient first and get some background information and some of the collateral information of what's bringing them in and symptoms. And then we're set up with the patient remotely. We're usually at Randolph doing this evaluation, and we're seeing the patient for an interview and making decisions about treatment and follow-up. And
what kind of symptoms would they present in order to make them candidates for this telepsychiatry interview?
That varies. It's typically from an emergency perspective, they're going to be patients that are more acute and need a decision made about whether they need to be in a hospital. So we're looking at decisions about safety, acuity of patients that might need a few days in the hospital or longer, or just to get connected into the system.
And so from a psychiatrist's point of view, as you conduct these interviews on television remotely, you're looking at the patient on a screen. They're looking at you, I assume, on
Correct.
A screen.
Yes.
You can be as accurate in your diagnosis and as certain of your diagnosis as you would be as if the patient were sitting in front of you?
Yes.
There's no difference.
No difference. It takes a little adjusting to that scenario, and it does a little bit for patients. But overall, you're getting the good picture of the patient. You're hearing what's happening. It's a great assessment.
When did CHS decide to take this step, and why?
Well, we actually started doing some telepsychiatry over 15 years ago, but it was minimal.
And you've been involved almost
since
the beginning
Correct.
Of that.
Yes.
Okay. And minimal in what way?
Minimal. We would have maybe two a month. So it really wasn't a huge expansion until about 5 or 6 years ago when our emergency department at Randolph had reached its capacity to take more patients from other hospitals. So we started reaching out to the medical emergency rooms and doing telepsychiatry. And over the years, we're now averaging about 350 a month.
Hmm. We could easily be doing 500 a month because we're trying to grow the program, get more psychiatrists.
And this is 24/7. This telepsychiatry operates 24/7.
But again, that's into emergency rooms.
Right.
And
right.
just to get back to what you had mentioned about, that's the technology that we developed and expertise that mm-hmm. we developed and workforce that we developed to provide that service in emergency rooms. And the shift, okay to do it there, but the shift is to do it in primary care. So one point about that is that if you look state by state and say, well, how many people are backed up in emergency rooms with psychiatric issues, that's a sign of how, the system is or isn't functioning. And in our state, a year ago, the University of North Carolina published a study that suggested that we have twice the rate in North Carolina as the rest of the country of folks with psychiatric issues backed up in emergency rooms.
Because there are fewer psychiatrists?
Because the system isn't functioning as well as a whole. So that relates to everything from workforce to who are the providers
outpatient
out
services.
There to how many people are insured or uninsured.
Now, I want to make sure that I read this figure correctly because you're talking about the need for doing this not just in the emergency room but across primary care. And you
right.
say, if I read this correctly, that 70% of primary care visits involved a behavioral health component.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been known. If you ask any primary care provider, what they're seeing, a lot of what they're seeing presents to them as back pain or headaches or dizziness. And even after lots of medical investigation, there's not there's not any answer that comes of that, not to mention people that actually do present with depression and anxiety and other mental health issues. And that really is the point about getting this technology into primary care, because, A, it's about scaling a resource more efficiently. Like you mentioned, there are fewer and fewer psychiatrists around the country to go around. Secondly, that's one thing. But secondly, it gets the treatment to the place of least resistance or upstream. So before things become bad, to get into an emergency room, we meet people where they are in primary care where it's easier to talk
about. So between the hospital systems and the doctor practices that you operate, and you operate, I don't know how many, but there are lots of them, because you see 10 million patients
right.
over the course of a year.
Yes.
How many of these primary care locations are being outfitted with this?
Well, we have 250 primary care practices in our system. And so our goal is to be in 12 primary care practices this year, but over the next 5 years to be in all 250. So rapidly to move it across our system. So the point is, telepsychiatry in emergency rooms is not new. We've been doing that for 15 years. We are good at that. But that's at the point of crisis. By then, the person is in crisis. And so the new is to move it back upstream into primary care before the patient is in crisis. When it's early, when the symptoms are early, when they're
so
in.
So how would that work? I come to see the doctor for back pain.
Yes.
The doctor decides he can't find a physical cause
Correct.
For the back pain. So it must be something
so
else?
So potentially there's another reason. So the physician would start to inquire, and there's an easy screen that the primary care provider can do. It's one page. 9 questions. It's called a PHQ-9. They can put it in front of the patient. Patient can fill it out, and with that screen can quickly tell that potentially there is a behavioral health problem.
So if they see that and they have the equipment, they would then
put the patient in front of the video, and our first level of screen is with a behavioral health provider. Doesn't even need to be with a psychiatrist. So it's very cost effective. We can do it with a licensed clinical social worker or a counselor, and they can do a further diagnostic interview with the patient. We can kind of see where this is going with the patient, start to do early diagnosing, and then our psychiatrists are working with the primary care providers on dosing algorithms, learning how to dose the medications, start the patient on medications, and then we do follow-up with the patient, telephonic health coaching. Did you get your prescription filled? Are you taking your prescription? Are you keeping your appointments? Make referrals to the psychiatrist if needed, but starting to protect that precious resource of the psychiatrist.
If there's a psychiatrist shortage, and you've said there is,
yes.
And you are trying to expand access through telepsychiatry to psychiatrists into your 250 practices plus your...
Through telebehavioral health, not necessarily telepsychiatry. So we're using access to behavioral health. Not necessarily.
What, psychologists?
So licensed clinical social workers, licensed counselors, all it's a virtual behavioral health team.
Okay.
So it's a virtual team that has pharmacy, psychiatry, counselors, social workers, health coaches, a whole team of resources that's available to the patient virtually. So whatever the patient needs through that virtual team. So it may just be a tiny little piece of a psychiatrist versus everybody having to have an appointment with a psychiatrist.
Is that team all within your system, or do you take advantage of members outside the CHS system?
Right now, mostly within our system. We do have some psychiatrists that work with us on contracts to help us with our telepsychiatry program, but most of the team's within our system. And we're hiring folks to work on our integrated virtual team to help support the team.
I have 15 seconds in this segment. Any other systems in the country doing this to this degree?
Not on a virtual platform that we're aware of.
Absolutely.
But definitely.
It's new and innovative to do it with a virtual team, but we can talk more about what it's based on nationally.
And we'll do that in just a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Griffin Brothers, Tire, Wheels, and Auto Repair, family-owned, serving the greater Charlotte area since 1961. 9 convenient locations featuring tire and automotive repair. Details at GriffinBrothers.com. Well, the Supreme Court largely upholds the Environmental Protection Agency's right to limit greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. And on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock, they'll discuss the ruling, what it means for utilities, and the Obama administration's efforts to combat climate change. If you'd like to join our conversation about telepsychiatry, well, now's the time. You can get to us at WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks or through Facebook or Twitter. And we are coming right back.
We're nearing the end of our fiscal year and hope you'll consider joining other listeners in this community and become a member by going to WFAE.org and make a financial gift to support the programming you use. Over 14,000 people annually contribute to WFAE, but more than 200,000 people listen each week. Take the next step now by contributing today to this locally owned resource. Contribute now at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about behavioral health and access to it, healthcare, behavioral health care through something relatively new, at least throughout the hospital system and primary care system, called telepsychiatry, with Dr. John Santopietro, Chief Clinical Officer of Behavioral Health at the Carolinas Healthcare System, Dr. Wayne Sparks, Director of the Emergency Department and of Telepsychiatry at CMC Randolph, and Martha White-Cotton is the Senior Vice President for Behavioral Health with the system, and Julie Roddy-Paul is a member of the Patient Advisory Council of the Behavioral Health Center at Davidson. This, as you said just a second ago, is based on the national model. Is this the one that came from Washington State? What's different between what you're doing and what they are doing there?
I think the primary difference is the virtual care platform, that we're, instead of embedding a provider in a practice, which limits their scope and the ability to leverage that resource, we're delivering the resources virtually, so over the telebehavioral health model.
And since the hospital system in the emergency department has been doing this for 13, 14 years, and you've been a part of that for 14 years, at least 13 years,
right.
Dr. Sparks,
mm-hmm.
Why just now are we moving into primary care? Is it because of the expense, because of the developments in technology that make it easier to deploy? What's going on?
I think it's probably a little bit of both of that. It's it is expensive to do the equipment and to provide those things for a lot of practices. But when you think about in a larger system approach, all of these hospitals or all these practices can't afford to have a psychiatrist, and it's not necessary. So we're actually providing a much better scale. And by having a hub of people doing this virtually, we're able to expand the service much more.
You launched a pilot program for this in March at Mint Hill Primary Care, which is 24/7. Does a primary? No, it's not.
No, it's the hours that the practice is open.
So, and both physicians and patients can access this, correct? I mean, are there physicians that sometimes get on the telepsychiatry line and talk to a psychiatrist about their patient before the patient is talking to the psychiatrist, or is it always patient to psychiatrist?
Well, I can try to answer that because it gets back to the model that you're talking about out of Washington, University of Washington. Doctors Jürgen Unitzer and Wayne Caton developed it about 12 years ago. It's called the IMPACT model, mm-hmm. and it's different in that it is co-located generally. So all the clinicians are co-located in the practice, which works well. To a degree, we had to look at our system of 200 plus primary care offices, and that's what drove us to really make it virtual. In their model, only 5% of the time does the psychiatrist ever need to actually interview the patient. All the rest of the care, which they literally call team, T-E-A-M, care, is driven by the behavioral health team. In their case, co-located, all that we did was take that, innovate on it by making it a virtual team. So all of a sudden that practice has access to all of the different roles that Martha was talking about in that team. And it's a very efficient and effective
scalable. Very scalable. And the interesting thing was people were a little bit worried about whether or not the patient would balk at the video, mm-hmm. you know. But the patients have been so relieved that you are going to treat me now, right this minute. You're going to give me access to care in this moment that I'm in your office, that not one patient has turned it down. not one, because they're so relieved that you're going to respond to me in this moment. You're not going to give me an appointment 3 months from now, 6 months from now. You're going to help me now.
Video conferencing in the office and FaceTime on your smartphone or your iPad.
So accustomed.
People have gotten, younger people particularly, have gotten accustomed. The older people may not be as accustomed with those practices. Do you see them balking at this at all?
No one has turned it down. They've done really well with it, and what they really respond to is the telephonic health coaching and follow-up, because they like this person reaching out to them and follow-up to the appointment, that someone's checking on me, someone cares about me, someone's making sure that the loops are being closed, that I'm tolerating the medication, that I'm taking the medication, and we recheck that screen to make sure that their symptoms are decreasing, that they're actually responding to the medication.
Are people with behavioral or mental, and let's talk about that for just 2 seconds. We're talking about behavioral health and mental health. Are they the same thing?
Well, basically, yeah. I mean, they're different terminology, and behavioral health is a more popular terminology right now.
Because there's less of a stigma attached to it?
I think that's part of the reason. It also speaks to the system. It also speaks to the final common pathway of a lot of brain issues is a behavior. So there's a bunch of things involved.
So people with these problems, do they need more coaching? Do they need this telephonic follow-up care more than, say, somebody who has an infection or a foot problem? Who doesn't need to be reminded of taking their medication?
I don't think it's different than any chronic illness. When you talk about compliance with any kind of treatment, it's the same with weight loss. It's why people go to Weight Watchers. It's the reason that people who are diabetic need to be coached with their diet. It's the reason that people in heart failure need to be coached to exercise and do the things that they need. It's all about compliance. It's a chronic illness. It's the same concept.
Telepsychiatry is said to reduce the length of stay in emergency rooms. Do you anticipate that this will either speed up recovery or reduce the number of hospitalizations for people with behavioral problems if they have access to this?
Absolutely. I think the access is the big key to this, and actually what we've already said is trying to get people in before the crisis by doing it through the primary care offices is going to be much less costly, and they're going to get the treatment they need much quicker and recover quicker.
One of the reasons that medicine costs so much is because it requires people, highly educated people, on the opposite side of the patient. Does this reduce costs in some way?
It does. I mean, through the emergency departments and what we've been doing, we're actually able to discharge from emergency departments about 40% of the patients that we see, which if we didn't have this system in place doing this, most of these, if not all of these patients, would be waiting in emergency departments for days or weeks to get to a psychiatric hospital, and they may not even need inpatient treatment. So we're absolutely reducing costs in that way.
More to that point, and again, to bring it back to North Carolina, because states are very, very different, North Carolina Hospital Association started looking at some of the numbers now in behavioral health, and the average length of stay for someone with a psychiatric diagnosis in North Carolina is about 32, 34, 36 hours, something like that. If they need a hospitalization, particularly in a state hospital bed, that goes to 3 days, the average length of stay. So what Wayne is talking about and you're referencing, instead of them sitting and being warehoused, which does happen too often in a psychiatric – in a hospital bed in an emergency room, treatment gets initiated. So a number of those people get treatment over those 3 days and can be discharged. And even if they get hospitalized, you've just cut off 3 days from their hospitalization. So we found that in another project that we're doing in our metro area emergency rooms to use a virtual behavioral health team deployed to those emergency rooms to back up telepsychiatry, that those lengths of stay have been decreasing.
You've worked in Maine and Massachusetts and Connecticut and now here in the Carolinas, Dr. Santopietro, and you say that there have been and continue to be substantial challenges confronting both the healthcare community and the community at large when it comes to behavioral health. And off the air, one of you mentioned that it is sometimes more difficult for patients who have insurance to get this help as opposed to if you are uninsured. How can that be?
Well, and to back up what you said about states, right? So, again, there's wide variability state by state. This is how we do mental health, is state by state. So just one data point. In Maine, where I worked, we spend $350 per capita on mental health. In North Carolina, we spend about $165 per capita. In South Carolina, for instance, $59 per capita. Now, that's not the only correlate to the quality of care, but it just gives you a sense of just how widely things vary state by state.
Is that because the cost of living in South Carolina is less than the cost of living in the Northeast? Or is that something to do with the amount of dollars devoted to that from governments?
It has more to do with how governments make decisions, how the policy is set up, and all of those things. And again, it's not the only measure, but it gives you just some sense of how widely things vary. But back to your point about insurance, there's many ways to answer that question, but one is that if you're a parent and you have a teenager who ends up having one of these severe mental illnesses and needs, like, you know, have, say, schizophrenia and very symptomatic and needs significant wraparound services such as group homes, case management, this kind of thing, those are things that insurance companies don't pay for. They parents are often faced with the choice of you may have heard this in the media recently with some of the things that have been going around, giving their child up as a ward of the state in order for them to be insured through the state, you know, plan to get those kinds of wraparound services. Just awful things that have been going on.
Why do we do that? Why is it a state-by-state thing? Why do we do things differently state-to-state? It just seems ridiculous to me, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, there's variability state-to-state in all of healthcare. In mental health care, it's more significant because of the history of how it's developed and the history of mental health care spending, and then also by virtue of the fact that there's just less money going into it. So it accentuates the problem.
And because it's funded by Medicaid, which is delivered at the state level.
So are the outcomes – people will often say we know that per pupil expenditures in education are different state to state and in some case county to county, and some people will tell you that money isn't the issue with education. Are there different outcomes state to state? Can you look at a state that spends more per patient on health care and mental health care and say that the outcomes in those states are where they're spending $329 a patient versus South Carolina where they're spending $59? Are there different outcomes?
There's two answers to that. One is that, A, we don't in behavioral health do enough around measuring outcomes. That's worth saying. The second, though, is that one place you can look for that is NAMI, the National Association for Mental Illness, has a website, and they do a scorecard every year. They give a grade state by state. And there's correlation, but it's not a one-to-one correlation around the dollar amount. But absolutely, there is a correlation.
Do more people fall through the cracks where there is less money per patient being
spent?
Well,
we just – I mean, yeah. For instance, in North Carolina, we have twice the rate of folks ending up in the emergency room, which I think is a sign of how they can't get access to treatment.
And prisons.
And Jen, on Facebook – yes, a lot of people who have mental problems end up in prison, and they should be ending up in hospitals, correct?
Yes. Correct.
Jen, and it costs a lot more to send a person to prison. Jen, on Facebook, I'm a licensed professional counselor in North and South Carolina with distance counseling certification. Please speak about insurance coverage or lack of coverage for distance counseling.
There is none, virtually. I mean, you asked a question earlier about why we had not done the virtual care into our primary care practices earlier, and that's really because there is no reimbursement for it. There's very little reimbursement for telepsychiatry in our emergency rooms. So there is almost no reimbursement, very little insurance coverage.
So what happens in those cases where a person either is insured but he's not going to be he or she is not going to be reimbursed and you're not going to be reimbursed by the insurance company? What happens in those cases?
We're currently not charging. We are looking at the value of providing the service and improving the person's overall health and the decrease in overall healthcare spending.
So that impact group that has done more and more studies in recent years, they were always showing better outcomes in terms of mental health and physical health, but in recent years have been showing return on investment, which is about $7 for every dollar that you spend in integration.
Now, Julie, you were a patient before you were a member of the Patient Advisory Council, and you are on the council at the Behavioral Health Center at Davidson. And one of your concerns is lowering the barriers to getting Yes. Care. How is that being done? Obviously, telepsychiatry Absolutely. Is part of it, but what are the other ones?
Well, one of the things that I really am excited about at Carolinas Healthcare and being a part of this board is that they're now embracing the patient more with being a partner in their care. That means that they'll probably get more resources. They'll be more involved in what their treatment plan is. So part of what I do in my volunteer role is to help provide some patient voice across the hospital or the home and community-based care. Our advisory provides a direct influence on some of the policies or programs and practices that affect that patient, either safety, care, or services. And recently, as an example, we created as an advisory board a new welcome booklet to help the families understand more about what to expect, because mm-hmm. I knew that in my particular situation, families sometimes felt they were disconnected, they didn't know what to do, they felt helpless as well. So some of these new things are going to help break down some of the barriers and get people some resources.
One of the barriers we talked about very early on is the stigma that Absolutely. Is often attached to this, and reducing the stigma is one of the goals of this program at CHS. Do you believe if there were less of a stigma that we would see fewer Sandy Hooks, Columbines, Aurora, Colorado situations?
Oh, I do, absolutely. I mean, that's a major aim of the new behavioral health service line at Carolinas Healthcare System, which is to change the culture, reduce stigma. One of the things we won't have time to talk about is that we're really pushing in a big way mental health first aid, which is a wonderful program. Again, been around for 10 years, but now just getting traction. Back to what Julie was saying, you know, as she was talking, I was thinking, we often hear now in healthcare circles that behavioral healthcare is the secret sauce to success in healthcare reform, where healthcare is going. And I was thinking, you know, with Julie talking, that the voice of the patient is the secret sauce of making behavioral healthcare better. And I think we don't speak about that enough. It has to do with looking at things from the patient's point of view, so that every one of those interactions, you talked about resources being precious, not having enough psychiatrists, even other behavioral health professionals around. So every one of those interactions is ever more crucial and could be successful or not successful. And thinking about things from the patient's point of view is a huge win.
Dr. John Santo Pietro is the Chief Clinical Officer of Behavioral Health at Carolina's Healthcare System. Martha Whitecotton is the Senior Vice President in charge of the business side of all of that. Dr. Wayne Sparks is Director of the Emergency Department in Telepsychiatry at CMC Randolph. And Julie Riley Paul is a member of the Patient Advisory Council of the Behavioral Health Center in Davidson, which just recently opened, by the way. Thank you all for the hour.